have been kept for more than 100 years, a log which one might think is good enough for a highly accurate guess. But 1976 and 1977, two unprecedented drought years, lowered the average rainfall figure from 20.66 to 19.33 inches. In a marginal farming region such as the Great Plains, an inch less precipitation can mean all kinds of trouble. In a desert region such as the Southwest, utterly dependent on one river, a difference of a couple of million acre feet can spell disaster. The first serious doubts about the 17.5 million acre foot figure were raised by Raymond Hill, a distinguished hydrologic engineer, at a conference in Washington, D.C. in 1953. The discharge of the Colorado River at Lee Ferry, near the Arizona-Utah border, Hill told his disbelieving audience, has averaged only 11.7 million acre feet since 1930. As Hill pointedly noted, the Colorado Basin states had not only been counting on 17.5 million acre feet per year, they had been building and planning as if they thought that figure was conservative. But during the period from 1930 to 1952, the river's annual average had fallen nearly 6 million acre feet shy of the accepted safe yield. He didn't need to tell his audience that this was enough water for 30 million people, or a couple of million acres of irrigated farmland, maybe more. As it would do on innumerable occasions, the Bureau refused to believe any expert who told it what it didn't want to hear. 3 years later, it was frantically lobbying the Colorado River Storage Project through Congress, as if it considered Hill's figures bunk. If he was right, some of the upper basin reservoirs it wanted to build might never fill. Then, despite mounting evidence that Hill was more right than wrong, it began planning the Central Arizona Project, which would divert another 2 million acre feet from the lower basin to Phoenix and Tucson and the sinking farmland in between. Even as it continued to hold forth for 17.5 million acre feet, however, the Bureau was beginning to develop some serious internal doubts. Doubts which it would attempt to conceal for several more years, but which, in the meantime, would lead it on the most ambitious quest for water in U.S. history. On August 18, 1965, the Bureau's resident expert on the Colorado River, Randy Ryder, forwarded a long letter to Commissioner Floyd Dominey by blue envelope. Blue envelope mail was meant to be seen only by the commissioner, the regional directors, and a small handful of top assistants. It was the Bureau's version of a diplomatic pouch, and the contents usually meant trouble. Ryder, a hydrologist and a bishop in the Mormon Church, had just attended a meeting of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, a group whose purpose is to prevent a single drop of water from leaving that state's borders without first having been put to beneficial use. The featured speaker at the closed-door meeting was Royce Tipton, a consulting hydrologist in whom the Bureau placed considerable stock. Tipton's reluctant conclusion, Ryder told Dominey, was that there is not enough water in the Colorado River to permit the upper basin to fully use its apportionment of 7.5 million acre feet and still meet its compact obligations to deliver water at Lee Ferry. Tipton's estimate of the river's flow was a lot more optimistic than Hill's had been, but even he felt that it should be set no higher than 15 million acre feet. In that case, if one divided the shortage equally between the two basins, each would be left with 6.3 million acre feet. After you deducted another 1.5 million acre feet or so for evaporation, and another 1.5 million acre feet for Mexico, you had a figure low enough to throw seven states into panic. The implications were enough to make the Bureau panic, too. The Colorado River Storage Project, which it had begun to build, Glen Canyon Dam was already completed, and the Central Arizona Project, which it dearly wanted, were both predicated on the availability of 7.5 million acre feet to each basin. What if it invested billions in both projects, only to find that there wasn't nearly enough water in the river to operate them? The upper basin projects in particular were critically dependent on the full volume of water flowing through the dams. That was the only way the Bureau could generate enough hydroelectric income to give them the illusion of being economically viable. A shortfall of nearly 2 million acre feet could initiate a chain of bankruptcies among thousands of farmers, or else force the Bureau to appeal to Congress for rescue. It would also open up a ghastly can of worms involving water rights. Would the shortages come equally out of each basin's hide, or would the earlier projects invoke seniority and try to keep their water under the doctrine of appropriate rights? Obviously, the new figures could knock the whole painstakingly constructed edifice of the Colorado River Compact into rubble. And what would happen when someone discovered that the Bureau had been ignoring warnings such as Hill's and Tipton's for years? As far as Ryder was concerned, there was only one way to face it. "It is futile to argue about an inadequate water supply," he wrote to Dominey. "Future development in the Colorado River Basin is dependent upon the future importation of water to augment the dependable supply in the basin." He suggested that, as a minimum, the Central Arizona Project legislation pending before Congress be rewritten to contain a conditional authorization of an import plan of at least 2.5 million acre-feet. Ryder didn't say where 2.5 million acre-feet of water from outside the basin should come from, but he knew, and Dominey knew, that there were only a few places where it could come from. That much unappropriated water couldn't be found within 800 miles. It could come from the rivers of far northern California. It could come from the Pacific Northwest. Or it could come from Canada. The idea of relocating distant rivers into the depletion-haunted Colorado Basin, augmentation, was the euphemism of choice, was really nothing new. One of its earliest and most relentless proponents was William E. Warren, who was brought into the Bureau by Mike Strauss and later built the California Water Project under Governor Pat Brown. As a young boy, Warren had moved from Indiana, average precipitation 36 inches per year, to the Imperial Valley of California, average rainfall 2.4 inches per year, and Warren seems never to have gotten over the shock. A smooth, handsome, genial sort, though even some of his fellow Bureau men considered him water mad, Warren in his later years would raise his voice to shouting pitch over just one issue, the ridiculous waste that was condoned by continuing to allow the rivers of Northern California to spill practically unused out to sea. It was unconscionable, Warren would say, that those rivers were so near, within striking distance, as he put it, and still undammed. Warren was haunted not only by the desert, but by the desert's growth. As a boy in the Imperial Valley, he heard stories about how it had been when not a soul lived there 10 years before. By the time his family arrived, 40,000 people had already moved in. 5 years later, another 40,000 had come, and the valley was appropriating about 20% of what was then considered to be the Colorado's flow. In the same period, the population of Los Angeles had gone from 100,000 to 500,000 people. "It was the wonder of the world," Warren mused, "how that city grew." By the time he became Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Water and Power in 1949, Bill Warren had developed an obsession, rerouting the fabulous amount of water that spilled into the Pacific from Eureka on north. The engineering study that would determine how best to do it was called the United Western Investigation. It is, to this day, the best-kept secret in the history of water development in the West. People who have been in the business all their lives have never heard of it. Since it would involve the movement of unprecedented flows of water over unprecedented distances at unprecedented expense, the investigation would need someone of unusual vision and character to lead it. And Mike Strauss and Bill Warren would have to go outside the Bureau to locate him. They found him in Bogota, Colombia, building dams for the descendants of conquistadors. His name was Stanford P. McCasland. Stan McCasland had worked in the planning division of the Bureau for some years. He quit, evidently, because the predictable tedium of designing small projects on small rivers was something which he considered beneath him. In South America, where you could find unnamed tributaries of the Amazon bigger than the Colorado, he at last found the landscape of his dreams. Like a lot of Bureau engineers, McCasland had only a faint interest in irrigation. It was damming rivers that got his juices flowing. An irascible Scot, he viewed rivers not so much as challenges or opportunities, but as willful monsters to be beaten into submission. In the likes of him, the rivers had an unlikely foe. "He was skinny as a rail," says Pat Dugan, a longtime bureau engineer who worked with him, "and he had a shock of flaming red hair that made him look as if the top of his head had ignited. He always wore a tweed suit that was about three sizes too big. He looked like he could turn around 180 degrees in that suit while the suit stood still." The investigation took 2 years to complete. Its conclusions filled several volumes with descriptions, economic analyses, appendices, and maps. To Clarence Kuiper, a young engineer recruited from the Corps of Engineers, "It was the closest I ever came to feeling omnipotent. We were looking at ideas even Mike Strauss hadn't thought of yet." The UWI team raced around the Pacific Rim like Rommel's army, concocting schemes to put deserts to flight. They dinged rock samples out of canyon walls. They traced future reservoir basins by air. They floated rivers and explored by jeep. They spread contour maps across the floors of rooms and built tunnels and aqueducts with pencils. They spread oceans of theoretical water over horizons of potential farmland. On paper, they turned half the Southwest green. "Strauss told us to look at every possibility," Kuiper would recall years later. "He said, 'Don't you laugh at a goddamn thing.' Well, we didn't. We looked over every harebrained idea that ever came up. We looked at an undersea pipeline from the mouth of the Columbia to Los Angeles Lord. We found every conceivable place where you could divert the Columbia. We looked into jumping the Willamette out of its bed at Oregon City and turning it right around in an aqueduct to California. Southern Oregon is a big mess of mountains, so we plotted a tunnel that would have been 135 miles long. We had one guy in the bureau who thought you could keep wall-to-wall tankers moving between the mouth of the Columbia and L.A., so we looked at that, too." If anything, the United Western investigation suffered from a surfeit of choices. "Numerous possibilities exist for the interbasin transfer of supplies into water-deficient regions," wrote McCasland in the cover document, which bore the splendidly militaristic title "United Western Investigation, Interim Report on Reconnaissance, Report of the Chief." You could, for example, take a few million acre-feet out of the Snake River at Twin Falls, Idaho, pump it up the south side of the Snake River plain in 15-foot siphons, and drop it into the Humboldt River, the only constant river in the state of Nevada, meandering small and forlorn beside Interstate 80 for 300 miles until it disappears in shallow, salty Humboldt Lake. Then you could move the suddenly prodigious Humboldt straight across seamless desert to the Owens Valley, 200 miles away. You could tunnel 30 miles under the White Mountains and just dump it in. Then you could quadruple the size of everything Los Angeles had built to divert the Owens River and move the mingled waters of the Snake and the Humboldt and the Owens to L.A., to San Diego, to the Mojave Desert, and dump the surplus in the Colorado to satisfy our treaty with Mexico, leaving the other basin states with a whole Colorado to hoard for themselves. Alternatively, you could build a whole series of dams at a more or less equal elevation on the bigger rivers of coastal Oregon, and at a level approximate to the elevation of the upper Sacramento Valley, run a gravity diversion aqueduct from reservoir to reservoir, picking up 500,000-acre-foot increments as a bus picks up passengers, then run the aqueduct beneath the Siskiyou Mountains and plop the water into Shasta Lake, then lead it south from there. You could take millions and millions of acre-feet out of the Ponderay in Washington, an obscure river bigger than the Wabash or the Hudson or the Sacramento, and move it by gravity. Aqueduct tunnel, aqueduct tunnel, aqueduct tunnel, from Albany Falls, near the Canadian border, across the deserts of eastern Washington and central Oregon, all the way to California, passing by the Rogue and the Illinois, and picking up some surplus flows, with the end result that California's developed water yield would be increased by nearly one-half. The total length of the aqueduct would be about 1,020 miles, of which 290 miles would be tunnel and 40 miles in siphon. No estimates of cost were made for this plan because the necessary length of aqueduct causes it to appear unattractive. Most or all of these diversions, the report of the chief implied, would have to be built sooner or later. Regardless of magnitude, scope, and timing of the undertaking, If it can be shown that moving surplus waters of the Northwest to water-deficient areas elsewhere is in the realm of sound public interest, it is, in Reclamation's opinion and half-century of experience, only a matter of time before exhaustion of nearer water supplies forces the undertaking of a suitable project for that purpose. All of this, however, might still be 50 years in the future. For now, the immediate need was in the Colorado Basin and its parasitic appendage, Southern California, and the obvious river of rescue was the Klamath. Remote, wild, half-forgotten, the Klamath was a perfect example of how God had left the perfection and completion of California to the Bureau of Reclamation. The second largest river in the state, 3 times the size of the third largest river, it was imprisoned by mountains and hopelessly remote from Los Angeles. Spilling out of Klamath Lake in southern Oregon, a huge shallow apparition cradled between mountains and desert, the river drops across the California border and bends its way westward toward the coast. Then it dips suddenly southward toward populated California and, as if recognizing covetous intent, immediately doubles back on itself and flees to Oregon through the plunging topography of the Siskiyou Range. Diverting the Klamath would be easy along the first half of its course, but it doesn't contain much water yet. 100 miles from the Pacific, however, rainfall shoots up to 100 inches, the Trinity and Scott and Salmon rivers pour in, and the Klamath is suddenly huge. On a random day late in February of 1983, after a week of rain, the Klamath was flowing at 4,000 cubic feet per second below Klamath Lake and at 148,000 cubic feet per second near its mouth, a Niagara-sized flow in a canyon you could bat a ball across. Small tributaries were tumbling oven-sized rocks like ice cubes. To the Bureau, the Klamath's huge and reliable winter surges were only its second greatest attraction. The first was its availability. The Klamath was wasting 12 million acre-feet to the sea with hardly a claim on it. Its principal appropriators were salmon, steelhead, and bears. To capture the Klamath, you had to dam it 12 miles from the Pacific, then move the water in reverse across or under 100 miles of the most rugged topography in the United States. The dam, which would be called Apa, would occupy the river's last gorge. It would stand 813 feet high. The Pan Am Building in New York City stands 805 feet high. A man-made El Capitan, it would pool water 70 miles up the Klamath and 40 miles up the Trinity to form a reservoir with 15,050,000 acre-feet of gross storage. The reservoir that obliterated Johnstown, Pennsylvania, held 50,000 acre-feet. The Klamath, both forks of the Trinity and the Salmon River would, for all practical purposes, disappear. 98% of the salmon and steelhead spawning grounds would be lost. At least 7 towns would vanish, including the main settlements of the Hoopa tribe, from whose language the dam's name was borrowed and whose reservation it would drown. Only minor improvements, i.e. towns, exist in this the reservoir area, said the United Western Report. The site, in a dense meta-sandstone formation, was presumed to be safe, although it probably contains minor faults. Trinity Tunnel, which would spin water out of the bottom backside of the reservoir and carry it to the Central Valley, would be 60 miles long. Its shape would resemble a horseshoe, and its diameter would be 37 feet. There would be no tunnel remotely like it anywhere in the world. The Delaware Aqueduct, stretching from the Catskill Mountains to Westchester County, is 85 miles long, but its diameter is only 14 feet. Trinity Tunnel could hold 4 passenger trains operating on 2 levels. It alone would cost nearly $500 million in 1951, and it was merely the longest and biggest of numerous tunnels. The Tehachapi Tunnel, 40 miles long, would move the water through the transverse ranges, which cordon off Los Angeles from the rest of the state. 7 known fault zones would be crossed along the aqueduct route, and one of them, the San Andreas Fault, would present a fracture zone at least 2 miles wide in the middle of the Tehachapi Tunnel, which could pose unusual construction problems. An ordinary tunnel would shear if the fault slipped. It slipped nearly 20 feet in the 1906 quake, leaving Los Angeles unwashed and unquenched. Extra heavy supports would be required through this zone. The cost of everything, Apa Dam, the other dams, the tunnels, the aqueducts, the pumps, the canals, the receiving reservoirs, and an item called a peripheral canal, which would be built to carry the Sacramento's greatly swollen flow around California's delta, would be $3,293,050,000. It was an incredible bargain. Today, a couple of nuclear power plants cost much more than that. Had the Bureau reckoned how expensive life was going to become, the Klamath diversion might well have been built. In those days, almost everything the Bureau proposed was being built, Kuiper says. But Strauss decided to move cautiously on this one. If you read the report, you'll see that we were always talking about orderly development. That's code talk for building at a deliberate pace, taking care to butter everyone's bread instead of going gung-ho, which is what they did on the Missouri. In California, you had two choices. You could build a lot of little projects on tributaries of the Sacramento and the San Joaquin, or you could build one huge project on the Klamath. I don't know whether it made better sense to do one or the other. What I do know is that Mike Strauss was constitutionally incapable of seeing that the clock was already running out on these tremendous projects. He thought it was the other way around, that the Bureau would keep building bigger and bigger things. The only way Mike knew how to think was bigger and bigger. He and Bill Warren were sure the Klamath diversion was going to be built someday, so they didn't try to railroad it through. McCaslin didn't help. Contentious and prickly, he may have been a fine engineer, but he was the public relations equivalent of Sherman's march to the sea. Without asking clearance from the commissioner's office, he wrote an article describing the Klamath diversion for civil engineering in 1952. Northern California's 35 years of passionate opposition to Southern California's diversion plans can be traced directly to that article. McCaslin would not even say that these Pantagruelian waterworks would take care of the Southland's need for all time. The plan, described as a Northern California diversion, he wrote, would not by any means constitute a complete water supply for the Southwest. It would meet the most imminent demands, but it would more probably constitute the initial stage of a large plan to serve much wider markets a future economy might dictate. Clarence Kuiper says, "What I remember about that time is the phone ringing off the hook with reporters from Oregon and Washington asking me if it was true that the Bureau was planning to divert the Columbia River." But the outrage cascading down from the Pacific Northwest was the least of the Bureau's problems. Its main problem was at Los Angeles, for whose benefit the Klamath diversion had mainly been conceived, was unalterably opposed to it, too. The idea of the city it was trying to save, vilifying the project it had planned in order to save it, left the Bureau of Reclamation speechless. Had its engineers accepted a thing or two about law and psychology, however, they wouldn't have been the least surprised. Los Angeles, in the middle of an epic feud with Arizona over Colorado River water rights, saw the Klamath diversion as a ploy to encourage it to relinquish its claim on the share of the river that it wanted to consider its own. In fact, if any Californian even mentioned the idea of going north for water, Los Angeles came down on him like Thor. When Republican Congressman Richard J. Welch of San Francisco did just that, the Los Angeles Daily News denounced his idea as the kiss of Judas. "The San Franciscan," it fumed, "is trying not to succor but to succor us." As Carrie McWilliams wrote in California, The Great Exception, "To suggest that Colorado River water was not the only water which might be made available in Southern California was, of course, an act of treason, a betrayal." The Republican Party of the state, with its center of power in Los Angeles and Orange County, went so far as to mount an effort to excommunicate poor Welch, who, as bewildered as the Bureau by then, said he was only trying to help. The Bureau was flummoxed. Copies of the UWI report were buried in the archives in the regional office in Salt Lake City, where they sat under lock and key. Before he could do more damage, McCaslin was transferred to a desk job in Washington, and young Kuiper was left with a job of repairing the wreckage his boss had created. The Klamath diversion, potentially the greatest engineering scheme of all time, was dumped on the scrap heap of human dreams. "The whole thing kind of backfired on them," said Kuiper in 1981, still wryly amused after all those years. The Eisenhower era put transbasin diversions into the Colorado on hold for at least another 8 years. Ike's interior secretary, Douglas McKay, a Chevrolet dealer from Portland, Oregon, followed the honorable Republican tradition of using the office as a vending machine for timber and minerals, but recoiled at the idea of an activist government marketing water and power. Ike's water development policy, announced shortly after his inauguration, was that there would be no new starts during his administration, especially if the production of power was involved. His own Republican allies from the western states would soon make him eat his words, but his immediate problem, after his inauguration, was finding a reclamation commissioner who would do his bidding, an exact opposite of Mike Strauss. Since the Bureau had been stuffed with liberals, public power advocates, and super-engineers of the McCasland ilk during the previous 20 years of Democratic reign, he wouldn't be easier to find within the Bureau, whence commissioners traditionally came. After leaving the post vacant for several months, the Republicans finally came up with Wilbur Dexheimer, the Bureau's assistant chief construction engineer. Dexheimer was handsome, amiable, and a competent engineer, but he was, as Winston Churchill said of Clement Attlee, a modest man with much to be modest about. He had spent his entire career in the Denver engineering headquarters, and he was an ingenue at politics, which was the breath of life to Mike Strauss. Dexheimer was the first to admit that he was the consummately wrong choice for the job. As soon as he was appointed, he called his regional commissioners to Washington, gathered them in his office, and blurted out, "I don't have to tell you guys that I'm the least likely person in creation to be sitting at this desk. I'm ignorant as hell about what goes on in this town, but by God they made me commissioner, and here I am, and now you've got to follow my orders, even if you and I think they stink." To the routed myrmidons of the New Deal, the golden age of water development seemed truly over. But Republican principles would prove to be no match for the stark imperative of the American desert. In 1956, Ike would end up signing the Colorado River Storage Project Act against his better judgment, and the budgets of both the Bureau and the Corps of Engineers would increase dramatically during his administration. In the lower Colorado Basin, however, Eisenhower had an excuse to do nothing. Until the Central Arizona Project was given final shape, and that couldn't happen until a legal battle had ended and it was determined who had rights to what water, the river's looming deficit would remain an inconsequential fact. Once the lawsuit was settled, however, the Bureau would face two seemingly insuperable problems at once: how to build the most expensive water project of all time, and even worse, how to authorize an even more expensive augmentation scheme that would give the Colorado Basin enough water for everything it was planning to build. On a map of Arizona, the Colorado River can be seen making a wide circle around the northern and eastern half of the state. At every point along that 600-mile sojourn, the populated center of the state is walled off from the river by mountains. In the north, the river flows in a bottomless canyon, a mile below its southern rim. To lift it out of here and lead it to Phoenix would be out of the question, even though the water, once out of the Grand Canyon, could flow downhill all the way. Closer to its mouth, the river escapes its canyon confines and flows across broad, sandy wastes, but numerous ranges stand between the river and Tucson and Phoenix: the Aquarius Cliffs, the Black Mountains, the Maricopa Mountains, the Saucera Range. Regardless of where one located the point of diversion, to move a portion of the Colorado River to Tucson and Phoenix would involve a pump lift of at least 1,200 feet. Pumping irrigation water there would be like taking it out of the Hudson River and lifting it over the World Trade Center in order to water lawns on Long Island. The CAP was to be first and foremost an irrigation project, a rescue project to save the dying farmlands between Phoenix and Tucson. The cities would also get some water, but the farmers would receive the overwhelming share. Hardly anywhere on earth, however, is water lifted that high in order to irrigate crops, unless the water flows nearly as far downhill somewhere along its route as it was lifted uphill, so that much of the energy required to lift it can be recovered. Even then, the second law of thermodynamics exacts a heavy toll. For every 100 units of energy expended to lift the water, only 70 or so can be recovered on the way back down. Using the most optimistic predictions, high-value crops, high crop prices, dirt-cheap power from pre-existing dams, the Central Arizona Project was still likely to need more public welfare than anything the Bureau had built. A simple matter of physics, then, made the Central Arizona Project even worse, in an economic sense, than the Colorado River Storage Project. But politics demanded that it be built, and in the 1960s, Arizona had power. Barry Goldwater was the presidential candidate of the Republican Party. Carl Hayden was the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. He could, if he wanted, hold up every other water project in the country until his state was satisfied. And there was the issue of equity. California had its water, Nevada had its water, the Upper Basin was developing its water, and Arizona still had nothing. What were a couple of $1 billion in the face of these other, more important concerns? Still, something would have to be done about the project's horrifically poor economic rationale. And something would ultimately have to be done about the fact that the river now seemed certain to dry up if the cap was built. Something, but what? The obvious answer was a couple of big cash register dams that could generate enough power and enough money to give Arizona's irrigation farmers the 90% subsidy they would probably need. If the dams were big enough, there might be enough revenue left over to begin a fund that, in the future, could help build the gigantic augmentation project that the basin would require. But where could one locate the dams? There were no sites for big dams left in Arizona, and besides, the Gila River system didn't have nearly enough water to develop the kind of power the Bureau had in mind. California still had a lot of undeveloped hydroelectric potential, but it wouldn't think of allowing dams to be built within its border whose revenues would allow Arizona to divert water it was then using. The Colorado River Storage Project was cementing dams in all the best hydroelectric canyons in the Upper Basin. New Mexico's rivers had neither the sites nor the water flows. There was only one place in the entire Southwest where reliable water flowed through a section of river with a 1,000-foot drop, the Grand Canyon. The proposal for Grand Canyon dams was officially revealed on January 21, 1964, with the release of something called the Pacific Southwest Water Plan. One had only to read the title to see that, now that another New Deal Democrat was enfranchised in the White House, Lyndon Johnson was about to beat Barry Goldwater with 60% of the popular vote, the Bureau had happily returned to the mode of thinking prevalent during the FDR and Truman years. The plan was majestic. It contemplated two huge new dams on the Colorado River in Marble Gorge and Bridge Canyon, at opposite ends of Grand Canyon National Park. Both had been carefully situated so as not to flood the park itself, except for what the Bureau called minor flooding that would drown Lower Havasu Creek, the canyon's most beautiful side stream, and submerge Lava Falls, the river's most thunderous rapid. But the park would sit inside a dam sandwich. Bridge Canyon Dam would back up water for 93 miles below it, entirely flooding the bottom of Grand Canyon National Monument, and Marble Gorge Dam would create a reservoir more than 40 miles long right above it. The dams had one purpose, hydroelectric power, and a single objective, lots and lots of cash. They would not conserve any water because there was none left to conserve. In some years, they would cause a net loss to the river through evaporation. They were there only to take advantage of the 1,000 feet of elevation loss between Glen Canyon and Hoover Dams. Together, they would generate 2.1 million kilowatts of peaking power, marketable at premium rates. Later, the power revenues would finance an artificial river of rescue. For now, it would pay for the other features of the plan. One of those features, actually it was the centerpiece of the plan, was a pair of big dams on the Trinity River in far northern California, and a long, hard rock tunnel that would turn their water into the Sacramento River, where it would begin its journey to Los Angeles. That city, and its burgeoning suburbs would thus receive a huge surge of high-quality water from Northern California to replace the salty Colorado. The San Joaquin Valley would siphon off a considerable portion along the way. It was going to be rescued for the third time from its suicidal habit of mining groundwater. New Mexico would get Hooker Dam, which would inundate yet another scenic monument, the Gila Wilderness, and Utah would get two more projects. In the middle of the list, camouflaged under water salvage and recovery programs, was the most expensive item of all, the Central Arizona Project. It was the same multi-billion-dollar shell game that the United West investigation had proposed. New water from Northern California would take care of Southern California's needs so that the Colorado could be conserved for the Upper Basin and Arizona. Curiously, the United Western investigation did not even rate a passing mention in the report, though it dwelled at some length on earlier plans to solve the Southwest's water dilemma. Evidently, the UWI was still so closely associated with a raid on the Columbia River that the framers of the Pacific Southwest Water Plan would rather have pretended that it never existed. Another name hard to find in the report was that of the Interior Secretary Stuart Udall. There were three possible explanations for this. One, the one conservationists wanted to believe, was that the plan did not really have Udall's support. He was, after all, being described by them as the best Interior Secretary since Harold Ickes. How could the best Interior Secretary since Harold Ickes wish to inundate the most stunning feature of the American landscape? How could he talk about the minor intrusion of a reservoir into a national park? Another explanation was that Udall, as a native of Arizona, felt that he had to distance himself from a plan whose ultimate purpose was to deliver a couple of million acre feet to his home state. A third explanation, the one conservationists least wanted to believe, was that Udall supported the plan, but didn't want to admit it. The most interesting curiosity about the plan, however, was the obvious discrepancy between the amount of new water the Trinity River could deliver and the looming shortfall in the Colorado River. At the moment the plan was released, the second-largest reservoir in California, Clare Angle Lake, was beginning to fill on the upper reaches of the Trinity. Its capacity of 2,448,000 acre-feet was not much less than the river's annual flow of 3,958,000 acre-feet. Clare Angle Lake was a main feature of the Central Valley Project. Its water, therefore, was exclusively for California's use. According to the Pacific Southwest Water Plan, only 1.2 million acre-feet would be left in the Trinity to augment the Colorado River. And that was assuming the Trinity, one of the world's great salmon and steelhead rivers, would be bled virtually dry before reaching the sea. But the shortfall which the Bureau was projecting in the Colorado Basin, privately, if not publicly, was at least 2.5 million acre-feet. Where would the other 1.3 million acre-feet come from? The Pacific Northwest Water Plan said nothing about it. It only hinted that it does not provide an overall solution for the region's water needs, then failed to mention what such an ultimate solution would be. The Bureau's maps had other reservoirs all over the place, drawn in gray, several on the Eel River, one on Cache Creek, the huge Apa Reservoir on the Klamath, but referred to these as alternative storage possibilities, as if they might substitute for, but not augment, the Trinity Dams. Where, then, was water for 6 million people to come from? In the Pacific Northwest, there was a lot of suspicion that the Pacific Southwest Water Plan was merely a smokescreen for a much larger plan, long a gleam in the Colorado Basin's eye, to tap the Columbia River. Such paranoia was inflamed by occasional speeches delivered to sympathetic ears by some of the Bureau's engineers, insisting that this was the final solution that would someday have to be built to allow continued growth in the parching Southwest. Officially, however, the Interior Department went to great lengths to reassure the Northwest that it had no such designs. Udall publicly scoffed at the notion of diverting the Columbia, and Floyd Dominey, the Bureau Commissioner, sharply reprimanded his underlings if they even mentioned the idea. But the truth of the matter was that the Pacific Southwest water plan was a smokescreen. The Columbia was on Udall's and Dominey's minds the entire time. On December 15, 1964, less than a year after the Pacific Southwest plan was revealed, a four-hour-long meeting quietly took place at the regal new offices of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. Built on a hill at one end of Sunset Boulevard, the MWD headquarters had a splendid view of the immense sprawl and traffic congestion it had helped create. Four freeways converged right below its windows, but it was walled off from same by a forest of fountains and, fittingly, a moat. The participants in the meeting were Udall, Dominey, Interior Solicitor Edward Weinberg, Los Angeles Congressman Chet Holifield, whose twin passions were water diversion and nuclear power, and seven carefully selected members of the MWD. Officially, this was a meeting that never took place, but as the chairman of the MWD, Joe Jensen, enthused in a confidential report to MWD directors, it was one of the most constructive conferences we have attended. Udall, he reported, expects to discuss with Senator Jackson of Washington a feasibility study and the eventual taking of 10 to 15 million acre-feet of water from the Columbia River. He would hope to have Senator Jackson lead off with a statement that the export program would be possible according to such guidelines as Jackson felt necessary for such an export program. Mr. Dominey, Jensen continued, explained that a group in Denver had been working for 30 days on a preliminary study to bring water from the Columbia River, and that by March he should be able to give a definite answer as to the route and the general features of the project, as well as a comparison of cost of this project and the cost of delivering water from California and desalting. Washington may need a stepped-up reclamation program, Jensen quoted Dominey as saying, in order to offset the adverse effects of closing down several federal installations in that state. The secretary stated two courses appeared to be possible at the present time, Jensen wrote his fellow board members. One, have a study made and defer action on authorization while a study is done right. Two, introduce a bill which would authorize the import program, Bridge and Marble Canyon Dams, Central Arizona Project, and a few of the other projects. By March, more definite information should be available, and it should be possible to have the committee report a bill to authorize the study and authorize the construction of the import program. Dominey indicated the first 6 months of any presidential term was the best time to hit Congress. He stated that the Bureau had never had any trouble getting funds once a project had been authorized, but it frequently had trouble getting projects authorized. Udall and Dominey, in other words, wanted to study the feasibility of the Columbia diversion after it was already authorized, on the assumption that even if it wasn't economically sound, it would be too late to stop it. Their real concern seemed to be lining up the political firepower that would let them succeed. And the plan, as Jensen described it, included so many gifts to so many states that it certainly ought to succeed. It contemplated numerous new irrigation projects in both Oregon and Nevada, some more projects in the Upper Colorado Basin, and the stepped-up reclamation program in Washington that would make up for the mysterious facilities that might have to be shut down. Even then, Jensen said, up to 7.5 million acre-feet of Columbia River water would still reach Lake Mead every year. The plan, then, had to be far more expensive and ambitious than anything ever contemplated, more so, by far, than the Pacific Southwest Water Plan, more so even than the Klamath diversion studied by the Bureau 12 years earlier. That was remarkable enough. What was really remarkable, however, was that the water would be available at the present price of Colorado River water. To charge no more for Columbia River water delivered to Los Angeles or Arizona than was being charged for water from nearby Hoover Dam would be a feat as astonishing as Moses' bifurcation of the Red Sea. The water would have to come 1,000 miles by aqueduct. Hoover water came only a couple of 100 miles, and the immense power output of the dam subsidized the big pump lift to L.A. Hoover Dam was financed with Depression-era interest rates and built by workers earning $4 a day. This project would be financed by Vietnam-era interest rates and built by unionized labor earning at least $6 an hour. There would be little, if any, hydroelectric power produced, but a lot of power might be required for pumping. the water had to go over or through two major mountain ranges. The difference in cost per acre foot ought to be at least 800%, probably much more. But according to Joe Jensen, Stuart Udall was offering it at the same price the MWD paid for water from Lake Mead. Somewhere, there was an immense subsidizing engine, but where? In his memorandum, Jensen merely hinted at an answer. It may have sounded so good he didn't believe it himself. The cost of such Colorado River supply, he wrote, is to be paid out of the first power revenues. The remaining power revenues would be available for assisting in the payment of the main program or project, and water revenues would pay part of the cost. Apparently, Jensen was promised by Udall and Dominey that the power revenues generated by the dams that would be part of the import scheme were going to subsidize the price of water before they even began to pay back the cost of the facilities. Before the dams were paid for, before the aqueducts were paid for, before the tunnels were paid for, before the siphons and canals were paid for, before a penny went to all of that, the power revenues were going to go directly into the pockets of water consumers in southern and central California and Arizona, subsidizing the price of their water. How else could Udall be promising the Southwest water, water that probably wouldn't be available until the 1980s, at 1935 prices? If this is what it took to get the Central Arizona Project built, and Jensen, a leading foe of that project, did not say an unkind word about it in his memorandum, Udall and Dominey were just about prepared to give the water away. In an economic sense, what the backers of the Pacific Southwest Water Plan were proposing was unprecedented. It violated every principle of economics, even the fast and loose principles of reclamation economics. If the lion's share of the power revenues were going to subsidize not only irrigation, but municipal water costs, municipal water whose revenues had usually subsidized irrigation in the past, the project could not possibly be paid back for hundreds of years, if ever. The cost, which had to be in the many billions, would simply be borne on the backs of the taxpayers. From a national perspective, it was a stunningly ill-conceived idea. But from a regional perspective, it was a wonderful idea, an offer none of the basin states could refuse. At a price guaranteed to be affordable, not only affordable, but dirt cheap, the yield of the Colorado River would be increased by one half. Oregon would get a slew of new irrigation projects, as would Nevada. California's irrigators would be relieved of their most desperate worry, the self-inflicted groundwater overdraft. And it could all be accomplished by taking a mere 10% of the flow of the Columbia River and turning it southward. Behind the proposal was a dramatic gamble that Congress and the public would go along with the idea, or, even if they didn't, that the Southwest had the political power to persuade them to. But how could one sell the public on a program that was supposed to remain a tightly guarded secret? On December 31st, 1964, 2 weeks after learning of the Columbia Plan, Joe Jensen sent his New Year's greeting to Stuart Udall, expressing very great appreciation for Udall's decision to support the project that had always been Jensen's dream. Then he added, "Since your program is to be kept confidential, there is little that we can do except give you assurance of our support and our desire to assist in every way." It must have been frustrating for Jensen. The Metropolitan Water District had the mightiest propaganda apparatus in the entire West, and he didn't dare push the button to fire it up. Maintaining a self-enforced silence about the proposal was actually the least of the proponents' problems. By 1965, the war in Vietnam was consuming an ever larger bite of the federal budget, and LBJ's anti-poverty programs also promised to cost a tremendous amount. No price had been put on the Columbia diversion, but the Trinity River version of the Pacific Southwest Water Plan was expected to cost $3,126,000,000. Going as far as the Columbia for much more water could easily cost three times that much. The federal budget in 1965 was only $118.4 billion. To persuade the Congress to authorize perhaps $10 billion for a single water project would take some doing. But the biggest and most unyielding obstacle would not even be the enormous cost. It would be the man who, Udall foolishly felt, he could persuade to lead the bill through Congress, a pugnacious 5'10" third-term senator and fellow Democrat from Washington State named Henry Jackson. In June of 1965, with no discernible opposition, Senator Henry Jackson tacked an innocent-looking rider onto an innocuous-seeming bill that established standardized guidelines for the allocation of costs to fish and wildlife enhancement. What the rider did, in a couple of brief sentences, was prohibit the Bureau of Reclamation from undertaking feasibility studies that Congress did not approve in advance. The effect of the maneuver, which few recognized at first, was the same as if Jackson had strung a 600-volt electrified fence along the entire south bank of the Columbia River. Without a feasibility study, the Bureau couldn't approach Congress for authorization. Without a congressional authorization, it couldn't build. Explaining his amendment to a couple of reporters who were smart enough to see what it meant, Jackson made no mention of the Columbia River. He was annoyed, he said, by the Bureau's habit of working up local interest and enthusiasm for projects in the field before presenting its case to Congress. Such tactics, he said, put Congress in a take-it-or-leave-it position when the Bureau came to authorization hearings with a gaggle of local politicians and noisy project boosters in tow. His amendment was nothing for the Bureau to get upset about. The Corps of Engineers has operated under similar provisions for many years. It was true that the Corps operated under a similar restriction. It was also true that it rarely paid much attention to it. But Jackson's rider had made illegal the feasibility study that Dominey had quietly ordered on the Columbia diversion. Jackson, who obviously had heard rumors of the secret plan, was out to kill it in its embryonic state. The Northwest had water to spare, but it no longer had power to spare, and nearly all of its electricity came from dams. To remove 10 million acre-feet from the Columbia River meant a reduction of several billion kilowatt-hours in power output, unless one diverted the water below the dams. The Bureau would undoubtedly want to do that, but suppose the pumping cost of a diversion from low elevation would add tremendously to the project's cost, and it made much more sense to divert above the dams. If the enormous momentum that could develop behind the diversion scheme really got rolling, the Northwest would look awfully selfish refusing to part with some of its superabundant water just because it insisted on paying 1/4 the average national price for electricity. "I told Jackson that we ought to let them study the idea," recalled Daniel Dreyfus, who was then the senator's closest aide. "There was no way it was going to be economically feasible. 20 years earlier, maybe. In the '60s, absolutely not. Let's let him study it," I told Jackson. "Study the damn thing and it will slay itself. It's a crazy idea." But his reasoning was that there'd be other crazy projects that got built just because they were studied. I still never thought it could get built, but he was right on that point. Without a feasibility study, which Jackson, as chairman of the Senate Interior Committee, would never allow, the Columbia diversion was still born. What is more interesting is how quickly the Trinity diversion died with it, even though Jackson had not publicly opposed it. One reason may have been that Los Angeles viewed it, as it had viewed the United Western investigation, as a threat, an implied source of water that wasn't the Colorado River. It didn't mind the Columbia, because that source was really big. But another and better reason was that it didn't make any economic sense. The Trinity River offered too little water at too great an expense. No matter what the cost or opposition, the Colorado Basin had to get its hands on the Klamath, the Snake, or the Columbia. Those were the only rivers left in the American West that were worth thinking about. It was actually the upper Colorado Basin states, not the lower, that were pursuing the water importation idea with particularly feverish interest. California wasn't worried. The Imperial Valley had so much water it was almost drowning in it, and Los Angeles had more on the way from the state water project than just being built. Through the cap, Arizona might soon receive most of its entitlement to the river through a single diversion. The Upper Basin projects, however, were small and spread all over the map, and few of those authorized by the Colorado River Storage Project had yet been built. Several, in fact, had been denied startup funds in Congress, partly because their backers lacked the awesome Appropriations Committee clout of the California delegation or Carl Hayden, partly because they were beginning to be regarded by some members of Congress as a scandalous waste of taxpayers' money, especially with a war going on. Floyd Dominey had told Joe Jensen that he always got funds for projects that had been authorized, but the Upper Basin was learning that, indeed, this was not always the case. At the languid rate its projects were being built, the Upper Basin would be the last to develop its full entitlement to the river. And when the over-appropriated river was played out, the compact might not mean a thing. Whoever was using the most water would end up keeping the most water. The various congressional delegations, especially the powerful one from California, would see to that. No one was going to turn off a spigot to Los Angeles, Arizona, or the Imperial Valley for the sake of a few marginal irrigation projects in the Upper Basin, especially if they hadn't even been built. Exactly how adamant the Upper Basin was on this issue became apparent for the first time at a secret summit meeting attended by representatives of the four states at Denver, Colorado, on January 18th and 19th, 1966. The subject of the meeting was the cap legislation that Dominey, Udall, and the Arizona and California delegates had coalesced behind, H.R. 4671. H.R. 4671 was a drastically trimmed-down version of the Pacific Southwest Water Plan. It authorized only the Central Arizona Project, Bridge Canyon Dam, Marble Gorge. The other Grand Canyon Dam had been dropped because its more meager power output didn't seem worth the inevitable fight, and a new aqueduct to Las Vegas. The bill also authorized something called a development fund, a receptacle for revenues from the power dams that, in the future, would help finance the augmentation scheme everyone knew would be needed. The legislation, in other words, authorized the projects that would ensure the Colorado River's early exhaustion. It also authorized the means of financing the basin's rescue. What it did not authorize, what it didn't even mention, let alone describe, was the importation plan itself. Udall and Dominey had evidently concluded that the development fund would be enough to mollify the Upper Basin. Only after Dominey's regional director in Salt Lake City, Dave Crandall, sent him his report on the Denver meeting did they see how utterly wrong they were. Of the four Upper Basin states, the one that seemed most intent on a specific authorizations for the rescue project was Colorado, within whose borders half the river's flow originates. This, from Udall and Dominey's point of view, was most unfortunate. Colorado's delegation was headed by Felix Sparks, the head of its Water Conservation Board. Sparks had won the Medal of Honor in World War II, among many other medals, for single-handedly storming a machine gun nest with a sidearm and a jacket full of grenades and killing half a platoon of Germans. According to those who knew him, he was not afraid of God, man, or the devil. He was also stubborn, vindictive, and a bully. But in Colorado, where water was concerned, he was king. According to Dave Crandall, Sparks had terrorized the Colorado delegation into asserting that a feasibility study of import must be a part of the cap bill, otherwise they would not support it. They would prefer an authorization of import, but recognize the impracticability of seeking such authorization at this time. Wyoming, he said, took a similar view. It feels that import is an absolute necessity for their future development and protection, and they desire conditional authorization. Studies of importation are an absolute minimum, and anything else would result in opposition to the bill. Utah was slightly less adamant than Colorado and Wyoming, but not much. New Mexico would accept a bill that only authorized the feasibility study, but nothing less than that. Between them, as Dominey well knew, the four states had the power in Congress to kill any bill they didn't like. Wayne Aspinall of Colorado was the autocratic chairman of the House Interior Committee, which would have to report out the bill in order for it to reach the floor of Congress. He could bottle it up forever if he desired. Clinton Anderson of New Mexico had similar power in the Senate, Carl Hayden notwithstanding, and there were plenty of others in both houses to be reckoned with. However, for all their insistence on an augmentation project that might be viewed as something akin to a military invasion by northern Colombia or the Pacific Northwest, the Upper Basin representatives were curiously ambivalent about the one item already authorized in H.R. 4671 that would generate the billions that would allow such a rescue project to be built, Bridge Canyon Dam. New Mexico observes that its inclusion could be untimely and unwise, reported Crandall to Dominy. Even the choleric Felix Sparks, he wrote, was inclined to defer to the lower basin states on this question.